Network Radio. I'm Mark Strassman. We're about to talk to Jeremy Rifkin, who has written The Biotech Century. Welcome to Book Radio.
Nice to be here.
Your book sets out the reasons why the 21st century will be the biotech century. You talk about seven strands that are going to do that. Why don't we take a minute or so? Obviously, they're complicated, but take a minute or so for each of those and give our listeners an idea about why the biotech century is almost upon us, or is already upon us, really.
When new economic revolutions sweep through all of civilization, there has to be an appropriate number of elements in place to make it work. There's seven operating strands that I've identified with the biotech century in the book. One, the ability to isolate genes and to manipulate genes, make genes the new raw resource for the new economic era.
Let's pretend our listeners have just been hatched and don't know what genes are. Let's talk
genes
about that.
Are the code, if you will, that orchestrates the development of an organism.
It's the information in the cells that says, make this protein or that protein.
That's correct.
Which
that's
leads to all the things, the eye color and the height and the baldness or the whatever.
But also we have to understand that those genes, while they code for those proteins, they're the ingredients, not necessarily the recipe. They interact with the environment in many subtle ways to code the proteins in specific ways.
Because in fact, they've co-evolved with environments, and therefore they manifest themselves depending on different situations.
Exactly.
Okay. So those are what genes are, and everybody has the same amount, everybody has plenty of them, and they determine to a certain extent who they are.
To a certain extent who we are. Now, the new biotechnology tools, what makes them powerful is that we can now take genes from totally unrelated species, stitch them into the genetic code of another species, and create novel forms of life for economic purposes that have never existed. We can put human genes into animals, animal genes into plants. We can cross species that have never been crossed in evolutionary terms or in breeding and create novelties. That's what makes this both powerful and chilling at the same time.
So, in fact, the creatures in Dr. Seuss are pretty much on the agenda here.
We've created mice now with human growth hormone genes that grow twice as big as other mice. We've taken the gene that emits light in a firefly, placed it into the tobacco plant, and it glows 24 hours a day. We've taken sheep and goats, which are totally unrelated, and we have brought together those embryonic cells and created chimeras, half sheep, half goats. And now Dr. Wilmot created the first mammal in history that was born of replication, not reproduction. Parenthetically, Dr. Wilmot's quote invention makes him the Henry Ford of the biotech age, the biotech century, because now you can mass produce identical copies of an original living creature, indistinguishable from that original, and you can customize genetic changes into that mass produced product. That's what brings us from the industrial age to the biotech century. So that's the first strand of the biotech century.
That, in fact, is the Bukowski a process from Brave New World.
That's correct. Alphas, betas, gammas, and deltas. If you reread Huxley's book, his dystopian vision written 50 years ago is now, that technology is now becoming feasible in the marketplace on the eve of this next century.
Right. So he was right, but he was...
he thought it would be 1,000 years from now.
Exactly. There's a discussion in some Bertolt Brecht play, I think it has to do with the city of Mahagoni, but there are government officials sitting around, and they say there's this dispute, there's this crisis, a conflict between the people and the government.
Be careful, because that's the one
solution.
That gave me that trilogy.
And the minister says, we need a new people.
Very appropriate.
Until now, that hasn't really been a solution, other than, I guess, genocide and taking over another country. With the technology discussed in the biotech century, though, this becomes not a real option, but an imaginable option for policymakers of the future, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We're making a fundamental transition out of the Industrial Revolution into the biotech century. And this is really a shift as important as the shift from medieval agriculture to our industrial urban way of life. It's going to force us to rethink all our basic suppositions about human nature and society. And now that we have the tools, if you will, to actually intervene into our own evolutionary destiny and begin to control the blueprints for all forms of life on this planet.
A lot of what you say depends on that transition being the case. So I want to really focus in on the way it's happening. What it was about the transition from the Middle Ages to the Industrial Age that was significant, and whether or not those same conditions are being repeated now as we switch from the industrial to the bioinformatic age.
For a new economic era to sweep into civilization, you need a whole series of strands to come together, social strands, cultural strands, perceptual strands, as well as economic strands. And, of course, at the beginning of the Industrial Age, we had the print press, We had fossil fuels and steam power and the Enlightenment and a new worldview. All of them gelled at the right time, at the right place.
And at the heart of that, the way I like to think of how history moves is through technology. New technology arose. I mean, obviously, the psychological and the theological.
They all came together. We don't know. They all parallel each other at the same time. What's happening now is two defining technologies of the last quarter century have been operating on parallel tracks. Computers and gene splicing.
Right.
The information sciences, the life sciences. They're now beginning to fuse together into a powerful technology revolution that sets the framework for a new economic era. Our futurists actually have done us a disservice by saying we're moving into the information age and preparing us for that. It would be like calling the modern age the print press age. The fact is, like the print press, the computer is not a resource. It's a form of communication. It's a language. It's a management tool. And just as the print press was essential because it became the management tool, the language, to organize fossil fuels and steam power for the industrial moment, the computer is going to be seen by future generations in its appropriate historic role. It is the language to download, to decipher, to organize, and to manipulate genes. Genes are the raw resource of the new economic epoch, just as fossil fuels and metals were the raw resource that we transform into utilities and goods during the industrial age. So we're moving from fossil fuels to genes, from the print press to the computer, and the biotech century is going to allow us to begin to trade in genetic commerce and begin to reconfigure the blueprints of the life process.
Before we talk for a minute about some of the advantages of having genes or information as the key to the age rather than a non-renewable, polluting, smelly black liquid, why don't we talk about the point at which the paradigm is most appropriate, I think, that of enclosure.
Yeah,
and how enclosure, the enclosure laws, and the enclosure of land, which was the fundamental resource then, shaped the industrial age.
I'm glad you've asked it. You're the first interviewer that's asked this question. It's key to understanding the historical transition that we're moving through. You can look at the last 500 years as a radical experiment in enclosing the various commons of the planet and reducing them to commercial property that can be then bartered and traded and negotiated in the marketplace. About 500 years ago, we began in England a radical experiment to enclose publicly held common lands and to reduce them to private real estate that could be negotiated in the market. Remember, people used to belong to the land in the medieval age.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, with these enclosure acts and acts of parliament, the land belonged to people.
Right.
We began an experiment where for hundreds of years we began to enclose all the great land commons, reduce them to commercial property that could be owned and negotiated in fiduciary terms. We then began to enclose the oceans and reduce at least coastal waters to commercial property. And then we began to negotiate an enclosure of the atmosphere, reducing the air to air corridors that have to be commercially leased if you want to transit through them. And now we're moving to enclose the most intimate commons, the last frontier, which is the genetic commons.
Okay.
Whoever controls the genes controls the biotech century. And in the biotech century, in the book, I open up the book with a look at the new genetic commerce and who's going to control it. Genes are the green gold. You cannot create a gene de novo in the laboratory. You have to rely on what's out there in nature in order to create these modified new living inventions in every field, from agriculture to animal husbandry, packaging, construction materials, pharmaceuticals, food and drink, and medicine. The life science corporations are scouting the planet.
Give us some example of these life science corporations.
We're talking about companies ranging from agrochemical to pharmaceutical, Monsanto, DuPont, Dow Chemical, GlaxoSmithKline, Novartis. Interesting enough, the mergers and consolidations going on in the life science industries as they maneuver to control the new genetic commerce dwarf the mergers and consolidations going on in telecommunications, software, entertainment, and computer industries, yet we hear much less about it in public policy and in the media.
Why do you think that is?
I think because the futurists actually prepared us for the information age rather than the biotech century. We're not realizing that the computer will fold in to this biotech century and be essential but not the sufficient element. It's simply the organizing medium.
So you're saying that the journalists who take their cues from the futurists have not been misguided, but are headed off.
We got slightly off course.
Right.
Slightly off course. We should by now have had a robust global discussion about all the environmental, social, and ethical implications, be they positive or negative, about the greatest shift in world history, the shift to genetic commerce and affecting evolutionary blueprint. But we have not had that discussion. Instead, we're still discussing the information age and encryption and questions like First Amendment rights, which are important, but far less important than the issues around genetic commerce.
So, in fact, the purpose of writing The Biotech Century for you was to get that discussion going,
yeah,
right?
We have to change focus from the information age to the biotech century and see the computer as the language for organizing genetic resources.
The word here is bioinformatics.
That's the key word. Bioinformatics and genomics. The heavy hitters, the big players like Bill Gates and Michael Milken are pouring money into this new field. I have Bill Gates quoted in the Biotech Century book. He says, look, it's about information, and the most important information is genetic information.
So his buying up of the Bettman archives is small change compared to buying up genes.
Absolutely. And I think your listeners ought to be aware of the fact that there is a mad race to literally patent every rare gene that exists on this planet.
Talk a little bit about the legality of that and the history of it, how the precedent for patenting life came about, and then we'll talk about the North-South issue in this.
Yeah, in 1980, in the late 70s, General Electric and a scientist named Ananda Jakrabarty went to the patent office in the United States with a microorganism genetically modified, and they said, we want to patent it. The patent office said you can't patent a living creature. If you want to, you have to pass legislation. The patent laws were not meant to cover living creatures. GE appealed to the appeals court, and by 3-2, the judges 3-2 said you can patent life. They decided, the majority judges, that life is only a composition of matter. And here's the key. The majority judges said that this microorganism looks more like a detergent than a horse or a honeybee. Any biologist could have told them it's an animal, a bacteria, but because they were so anthropocentric, they said, well, this doesn't look like an animal.
They were looking at those little soap sud commercials too much.
You got it. Exactly right. Had it been a horse or a honeybee, they would never have secured the patent. It then went to the Supreme Court. My organization provided the main amicus on behalf of the patent office, to which Justice Berger referred in his decision. Again, by one vote margin, 5-4, Justice Berger and the majority said, you can patent life. They said it's a narrow decision. We argued, along with the four justices who were with us, this will open up the possibility of patenting every single living thing and all the components and genetic blueprints of life, and unfortunately, we turned out to be correct.
Now, the importance of this argument, this legal argument, is that private enterprises claim they need patent protection for their, quote, discoveries of various forms of life, because if they don't, they can't make money out of it, therefore they can't set aside the investment to do the work,
correct,
and therefore mankind will suffer because of not getting this research. Is that the argument?
Correct. But what they don't say is that under the patent laws, you can't patent a discovery of nature. You can patent something that's unique, non-obvious, but if it's a discovery of nature, it's not an invention. Now, imagine the 19th century chemists who first isolated oxygen and identified helium or the other elements in the periodic table. Certainly it took foresight. They had to have processes to do it. It was non-obvious and unique, but it was a discovery of nature, so they couldn't declare it as their personal property. Can you imagine a scientist saying, I should have a patent on oxygen or helium, so anyone that uses these elements have to pay me a royalty? It's the exact same analogy with genes. Genes are not inventions. They're not discovered in a laboratory. They're discovered in nature. And I think what we have is, on the very thin reed of a one-vote margin in the appeals court, in the Supreme Court, on a narrow decision on one microbe, we've opened up the whole era of genetic commerce in closing the gene pool and reducing it to commercial property as if this is an invention. Now, here's where it comes important. We asked in 1987, when the patent office said you can patent anything that's alive if you modify it, we said, what about a human being?
Right.
They said no, because the 13th Amendment forbids slavery, so the patent office said you can't patent a human being, but you can patent every component of a human being, the genes, the cell lines, the tissues, the organs, and the embryo. Right now, the public may be surprised, but as we isolate each of the 100,000 or so genes that make up the human genome, life science companies are claiming patents. And within 7 years, life science companies will actually have under their control, as intellectual property, they will control virtually all 100,000 genes in our species and claim them as inventions. That is an extraordinary power over our own species and the future evolutionary development of our species. And it certainly raises very, very significant public policy issues that all of us ought to be concerned about. You remember when Dr. Wilmot cloned his sheep.
Right.
What had not been part of the public dialogue is that he has secured a patent, he has sought a patent in the U.S. and European patent offices. The patent covers human beings as intellectual property, so that as they begin to work on human embryos, if he receives his patent, which I suspect he will actually own human embryos as his intellectual property, as his private patented invention. Now, this raises the most impressive constitutional questions since we debated slavery and the idea of reducing certain people to commercial property in the last century.
Right, I want to get to the north-south dichotomy here and what that means. Most of the companies that are doing this enclosing are northern-based companies, and most of the genome that they're trying to enclose is in the south. What's the implication there? Who's working on it? Who's fighting back?
There's a tremendous battle emerging behind the scenes between northern companies and southern countries. The southern countries will argue, look, the genetic resources upon which this whole new genetic commerce and the whole new economic era depends, most of those resources are in the southern hemisphere. And they say northern companies should not be able to just scout the southern hemisphere, seek out indigenous knowledge about how herbs and crops can be used for everything from agriculture to medicine, then modify them slightly and patent them as if they're their inventions. The southern countries would argue that these genetic resources are to them what oil is to the Middle East. It's their national treasury. And just this week, in the new issue of Nature, which is coming out, they announced that the Organization of African American States has now come together, all the countries, and said, this is our resources, and you're going to have to compensate us if you seek patents on them. Now, the northern companies would argue that they add value by modifying them and patenting them. And the southern countries will come back and say, look, the little value you added is insignificant compared to thousands of years of cultivating these herbs and medicines and crops.
By the commons.
By the commons. Now, I would argue a third position, and that's increasingly the position of non-governmental organizations and some countries. This commons shouldn't be anybody's property. Southern countries shouldn't be compensated. Northern companies shouldn't be able to patent. We should maintain this as a commons for future generations. It's a shared legacy of our species and the other species we coexist with. And it should be like Antarctica. We kept that as an open commons. It can't be commercially exploited. And I believe that the issue of keeping the commons open and the issue of genetic rights is going to be, in the next century, what the issue of human and civil rights were to this past century.
As W.E. Du Bois said, the question of the 20th century is the color bar. You're saying it's the genetic issue for the 21st century.
Correct.
We've got about 6 minutes to go, and what I want to talk about now are some of the implications of all of this. And I think one good way into it is to just refer to a book that John Hersey wrote called The Child Buyer. And in that story, there's a really smart kid, and the officials from someplace come to take him away, and they want to take him to this experimental facility where they can make him really, really, really smart. And he doesn't want to go. And the scientists buy off everyone else in town with various gifts, but they can't get to him until they tell him that if he comes and does their work, he'll have an IQ of 1,000. And he says, okay, I'll go. And they take him. And that's the end of the book. And I think this is a pretty good metaphor for where humanity is sitting now, to be told, imagine what you can be.
Well, here's the problem. Prospective parents in the next few years are going to change their relationship to their unborn children. They're going to have a genetic readout within 5 or 6 years with DNA chips that will tell them exactly what genes they're going to pass on. Now, what parent wouldn't want to eliminate, for example, a genetic predisposition for childhood leukemia? If they
right.
could eliminate it in the sperm and the egg and knock that DNA trait out, why not?
They're going to want to eliminate the negative and accentuate the positive.
But then again, where do we stop? If you
right.
have myopia and
right.
you're going to pass that on, or short stature, or
right.
obesity,
right.
or left-handedness, the fact is that any parent is going to feel pressure as a good parent to provide the best possible break they can afford
from
for their child.
From their spouse, from their born child,
you got it.
From their peers.
But then this becomes the ultimate shopping experience.
It does.
The parent becomes the engineer and the architect of those not yet even conceived. Imagine the beneficiary, the child, growing up knowing that he or she is architecturally designed and the product of their parents' belief of what they should look like and how they should behave in the world. It really creates a new form of genetic slavery where unborn generations become, if you will, constrained by the genetics we set out for them.
Do you think, though, that people, I mean, we're both sort of speculating as to the psychology of these transgenic children as to whether or not they would feel better or worse knowing that they had been designed, or whether they had been the result of the random mixing of their parents'
genes. Well, it's interesting you raise this. I suspect, this is just a suspicion, that they're going to feel betrayed.
How will we know until we try?
Well, that's what a lot of people would argue, and a lot of parents and a lot of scientists would say we owe it to our children to improve their lot. The next great frontier for humanity is to take control of our own evolution and create a super species. I think that we know so little about evolution. Our values are so anthropomorphic to the moment. And once we begin talking about defects in our children and perfecting them, on the other side of that coin is the idea of the perfect ideal. Well, we all are riddled with all sorts of lethal genes. Who decides what the ideal baby should look like? And one generation's decisions may be quite different than the sensibilities of a generation not yet born. We're on the cusp of a eugenic century, and we better begin to raise some of these issues now before this technology runs its course.
Before we deal with the issue of the consciousness of these new beings, let's talk a little bit about the likelihood that they'll come to be. As I look around me now, it seems to me that when people have to decide whether private desires come ahead of common good, it's about 98% the private desires win out. And every part of our society and culture and economy are based around that. What's to stop this from happening, given those circumstances?
I have a section in the Biotech Century which talks about the public preferences on genetics, and Harris poll says that 43% of the country would make genetic modifications in children even before conception to improve physical traits. And when we get to mood and behavior traits, we need to understand we're already using psychotropic drugs to good purposes, and we're using cosmetic surgery more and more. Is it a big leap to begin to make those genetic changes before birth and before conception? On the other hand, I don't believe just because it can be done necessarily means it will be done. We have shown in the past that there are some decisions we take beyond the marketplace, and we have shown on occasion a collective responsibility to future generations. In the last chapter of the Biotech Century, I talk about two courses, two paths to the next century. This genetic science is invaluable, but it can be used for more than one technological path. Example, we could choose genetic engineering in agriculture with all the risks, but we could also use the same science to create a sophisticated organic-based agriculture for the next century with less risk. We could use the genetic science in medicine so that once someone gets sick, we actually change their genetic structure to make them well. Very risky. Or we could use the same genetic science to understand the implications between genetic expression and environment to create the most sophisticated preventive health regime in history. So I think there are many, many ways to approach this science. We need a debate on the options.
Let me focus on that again, though. If the issue is private enterprise to create a healthier person versus a social decision made through politicians who don't seem to me to be either informed or creative in their reaction to these issues, what's going to happen?
We need a generation to come forward and understand that the challenges facing them with this technological and economic revolution are unlike any challenges ever faced by a single generation in history. This generation and our children will decide whether we intervene into the course of evolution and become the architects of the future of biology on this planet, and if so, under what conditions. I don't know of any generation that's had to face that kind of daunting responsibility and challenge.
You're right. Victor Weisskopf, who was an emigre from Europe, from Hitler, came to the United States, helped build the atomic bomb, wrote a lot of books, a historian of science. He said, in mankind, the universe has become conscious of itself. What you're talking about here is now that it is conscious, it can create itself.
That's right. In the last pages of the Biotech Century, I raised this issue. It may be that the most important contribution of this whole biotech revolution is that it's going to force all of humanity to ask the basic questions again. What is life? What is human life? What's our responsibility as stewards to the rest of the living kingdom? So we may be forced into one of the great Socratic moments in history where we'll have to rethink all the basic propositions about life as we move into this technology revolution.
Well, the way people can do it, if they want to know what's going to be happening and have some input into it, would be to get a copy of The Biotech Century by Jeremy Rifkin and read it and start that discussion going as soon as possible with other people. And that's what we're glad to have you here today to help us do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.